Welcome to the Voices from Afghanistan series, a five-part audio blog where we explore stories from Wisconsin veterans who served in Afghanistan from 2001 to the present. My name is Matthew Scharf. I'm joined by Rachel Halaska.
Hi.
And Tristan Krause.
Hi.
We are the summer interns for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Program. Thank you for listening.
The war in Afghanistan is the longest-standing military conflict in United States history, starting in 2001 and still going on today. In July 2016, the Obama administration capped troop levels at 8,400 service members. In June of 2017, President Donald Trump gave authority to Secretary of Defense James Mattis to reevaluate troop levels needed in Afghanistan as part of Operation Resolute Support. Given this development, we decided this was an appropriate time to look back at the historical record of this conflict.
All the segments in this series were taken from full-length interviews from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Collection. These interviews provide firsthand accounts and insights on the conflict in Afghanistan. This series will contain graphic descriptions and language that may not be appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. This installment will cover the daily life of Wisconsin veterans serving in Afghanistan. We have incorporated stories from interviews with seven veterans ranging across several military branches and occupations. These clips include overviews of living conditions and food on and off base, hazards of extreme temperatures, and conducting unmounted patrols in the mountains.
In this first segment, John Vandeloup, a finance officer with the Army National Guard, and Michael Agee, a crew chief in the Air Force, share their initial thoughts on Afghanistan.
That was where it started in 2001. And then we invade Iraq and Afghanistan drops off the map. And I still believe that. I still think that gets short shrifted over there in the media, that they forget what's going on over there, that we don't really, do the American people really know all the good we've done in Afghanistan with these provincial reconstruction teams, rebuilding the countryside? Is it where it needs to be? No. But they're making some pretty good strides, building schools, putting in wells and pumps, infrastructure, roads. They're still working on electrical grids and things like that. There's too much reliance on generators and such, even in Afghanistan. But you don't see that in the media. You just don't. And to this day, I listen to NPR a lot, and NPR does, I think, a fair job of it when they do it. But a lot of times it's Iraq, Iraq, Iraq.
I thought it was like more exotic because we didn't have all the troops over there, and it was more just at the time it was really kind of more spec ops based. So you just kind of, you had these smaller missions, but there was a lot of history. Like I forget the name of the battle, but. Operation Anaconda. I read up on that sort of things where some of these huge battles were going on. I knew there was a lot going on over there, but it wasn't in the press as much as Iraq was at the time. So I knew I was going to be at Bagram, and I knew I wouldn't really leave the base. So I wasn't really too worried about safety or anything.
Next, Patrick Dahl, a Marine heavy equipment operator, describes the countryside in Afghanistan, and Michael Gourley, a National Guard advisor, recounts the intense culture shock of traveling through Kabul on his first day in country.
And they're two completely different countries. When you go from Iraq to Afghanistan, Afghanistan is like going back 500 years. Literally like the movie Star Wars, when they show Luke Skywalker's home, and it's those little mud huts, and that's what Afghanistan is like. They're mud. At least I was in the southern Helmand province. They are living 500 years ago. They dig irrigation ditches. They ride camels. They use pack mules. And it's pretty crazy to see how different it is from, you can come from America and then go over there and see. Their biggest technology is motorcycles. I mean, they have motorcycles and they have little cars, but it's just not. It's a whole different world. It's hard to explain how different it is.
We the marshalling area for Afghanistan was Kyrgyzstan, and I can't remember the Air Force base.
Oh, okay.
we flew into an Air Force base there, and if I heard the name, obviously I'd remember it. But I mean, the only time I went through there was a couple days. I was there a couple days coming in, a couple days going out, and then from there you flew into Kabul in C-130s and landed there in a very remote area. And I was very surprised landing there because we got off the plane and there were this was a big shock, and I'm sure it would be almost for anybody entering a situation like that, but there were fences around and there were people on the other side of the fence. You had no idea how dangerous they were, and somebody's handing you your first issue of ammunition and told to lock and load and be ready. That first experience of this is for real, this is the real thing, is a real shock. Can you describe that a little bit, that feeling? Oh boy. I tried to think of the emotion that I had at the time. I had, a degree of excitement. I had adrenaline rushing. I realized how ignorant I truly was coming into this, and that 2 months down the road, all of this would seem much more natural. But right now, this is absolutely bizarre. The feelings, the smells, the sights, the sounds, the culture, hopping in the back of these trucks and being whisked through Kabul over to the local post, horns blowing, yelling for people to get out of the way as this comes through, obviously being locked and loaded, prepared in case anything happened, and having no idea whether it actually happened in these convoys, getting a gander at the local culture, seeing the state of dress, the state of poverty that exists in Kabul, how badly the city was run down at this point in time. Apparently, at one point in time, it was quite a grand city, but it, my first exposure to it was one that was quite impoverished and had been at war for 25 years, obviously, so it's not going to be at the level of grandeur it was prior to the Russians invading. So it was just intense culture shock. What it was.
I've interviewed other Afghanistan war veterans, and what you mentioned and they had also mentioned was the smell of the country. Can you describe that?
I think part of the smell had to do with the dust that was always in the air, but it was not a pleasant smell. It was kind of a dank, musky smell. And that's about the best I can describe it. It was not a pleasant smell, but it was a smell that eventually you became accustomed to.
Oh, right.
Didn't smell anymore until you came back here, and then it was a shock.
Yeah.
Next, Brian Martins, a firefighter with the Air Force, describes conditions at Bagram in 2002. Then, Chris Huffschmidt, a carpenter with the Army Reserves, discusses the challenges of using a bulldozer during an Afghan summer. And Patrick Dahl discusses NATO forces at Camp Bastion.
We would help other units. A lot of it was cleaning off the sand and the grit and the junk because we had the high-pressure hoses with our fire trucks. And water over there wasn't scarce. Drinking water was. There was a couple times that our supply lines did get cut or the weather was just too awful for them to land planes in. So they had to start rationing water, MREs. MREs. I ate them for 5 months before we even started getting fresh vegetables, fresh food, and I lost 40 pounds. Food in Afghanistan had much to be desired for. I mean, yes, we had food in our stomachs, but when I rode home, you know, they were like, well, what do you need? Cigarettes and food. Like, food. They don't feed you over there? Well, yeah, but it's... You can only put so much Tabasco sauce on beef stroganoff, and it's just...
Did you have a chance to get off the base at all?
Once. And that's only because me and a couple other guys were foolish enough to go downtown to try and bargain for bootleg vodka, Russian vodka, from the black market. silly idea, but we went down there with an Afghan interpreter, me and another, one of my fellow firefighters, and then one of the special operations medics that we kind of pal around with. Went down to the village, and I had never, ever seen so many kids under the age of 14 with automatic rifles. It was just flattened me. Anyway, they were like, okay, lock the doors, you know, like that's going to do a whole lot of good. And myself and my partner in the back, we had fully loaded guns. But, I mean, they're rifles. There's no way we're going to be able to pull them up in time to engage anybody if we had to. So the medic was with us. He's like, keep your hands close to the guns, but not on the guns. And we were trying to write in the dust on the dashboard, you know, how many bottles we wanted for, you know, we were getting like $100. And they started handing us bottles with the paper seal. You know, was busted. No, I don't want that. You know, afraid of being poisoned, you know, which had happened. Not with our troop, but other times. And that was the only time we went off base in Afghanistan. And I've got all the respect in the world for those guys that, you know, the Army troopers and special ops guys that get into those helicopters day after day. You know, if they survived the helicopter trip up into the mountains, then their fun really began.
Infantry doesn't understand how to run things, how to set up work schedules and stuff in terms of engineering. This is the middle of June, July, and we're in the middle of a desert, and it's hot and so forth. So you can't run your vehicles very much during the day, not during the middle of the day. You can run it as it's cooling off, but you can't run it when it's 110, 120 outside. You have to start running it when, you know, it's like, you know, early in the morning. First thing, you have first light, boom, you're running vehicles. You have, you know, end of the day, you run vehicles, you know, but you can't do it in the middle of the day. They had insisted so much on running things during the middle of the day that we nearly melted the engine on a bulldozer. One of the planning things that had come up originally in the beginning was they had rented from this general, you know, all these vehicles. And I said, that's a bad idea. I can get us vehicles, you know, dirt moving, and I can get us a bulldozer and a bucket loader. The exact same things they had rented from this general, but they were military, and said, if there's any issues with them, we can get the replacement parts like that. Oh, nothing will happen. Nothing. Vehicles won't break down, especially ones that have been maintained this well, you know, in a foreign country by a group of people that lives below the poverty line. So I'm sure these vehicles will be top notch and ready to go. Yep. So it didn't take long for the bucket loader to break. And the bucket loader was probably one of the most important things in terms of security, because that was loading a HESCO. And HESCOs are like 7 foot tall baskets. Large baskets are 7 foot tall, about 3 by 3 feet. And all your dirt and earth goes into there, and that becomes, you know, it's going to stop bullets and RPGs and stuff like that. And no, we won't worry about that. The quick solution from this female captain was, oh, well, let's just try and fill these things up with, our e-tools. Now, that's your little shovel that you kind of transforms, and, you know, it's a little tiny shovel, and it's kind of like a child with a shovel on the beach, and there you are with a bucket loader. It's no contest. You're never going to get done. And when I heard this, I just laughed and walked away. I just laughed. I was like, let me know when you guys get done with this. This is good. And she was like, come back here, Sergeant. Why? What's so funny? This is a great plan, you know. So they worked. She worked all her guys for like a day. or I don't know, maybe 4 hours in the evening on this. And they were no closer than when they started. And that's really sad. You know, I said, bring, you know, the bucket loader had a melting engine and a flat tire. It wasn't going anywhere doing anything, and there was no replacements. You know, it took them 5 days to get a replacement for it, and then they melted the engine all the way. So we had nothing. Not always being the one to say, I told you so, I had no problem saying, I told you so.
Outside, you know, smoke good memory, you start talking a little about, you know, I had one guy explain to me what they did, what actually Great Britain was, you know, you just start talking and telling them, they'd ask questions about America, and they'd tell us about Britain or wherever they were from. So I think that was kind of was interesting to me, you know, the guy to hear, what is your military like, and why do you guys do that, why do you wear those funny hats, kind of thing. I think some of them kind of resented us as Marines because we're very professional, and you know, we're always wearing your cover if you're outside. Always, you know, your uniform always looks nice, and a lot of the other countries are a lot more relaxed with that. But then when we showed up, their leaders kind of, they didn't want to be shown up by us, so then they cracked down on them, and so I think they kind of resented us a little bit for that. Kind of not showing them up, but you know, we took away their nice relaxed atmosphere. But I think it was probably good for everyone. Bastion did also have the only pizza hut. The British had it, and the British paid for it. That there was a little bank, and it was a bus, or what you call it, like a lunch wagon type deal. And yeah, they had an Afghan pizza hut. So it was. We make trips over there. I mean, that was on base. It was kind of the thing with some of our staff and COs that, you know, they want us to do something for them that was kind of, you know, under the table, or, you know, help them out. You know, I forgot to ask for this, can you do this real quick? Or, you know, these kind of side deals. You know, I'll give you your pizza. So they drive over. And they had, you know, the higher ranks, the staff and COs and officers all had a car, but they had cars and trucks and everything, not just like Humvees or something. They actually had trucks, so they'd drive over there. It was too far to walk. We had to actually drive there, so it's got a treat for us, and they go get it for us.
Lastly, Robert Warren, a Marine, discusses living conditions on a high-altitude forward operating base in 2004. And later describes the relationship between the Marines and his unit and service members living on base in 2009.
Tell us about the living conditions at the operating base.
Well, at the operating base, it wasn't bad. There they had, we're still sleeping outside, but they had camionettes for shade. A lot of time, we spent a lot of nights sleeping in our fighting holes because they did get rocketed. Not every night, but pretty close to it. Eventually, they opened up a kind of half-assed chow hall. The battalion's cooks did the best they could, but we were at the very end of a very long logistics train, so they did what they could, but everything was still pretty sparse. When we weren't on the forward operating base, we were moving with whatever we could carry on our backs. Trucks were breaking down. We're actually operating at higher elevations than a lot of the helicopters could fly, so we couldn't get resupply. Air support was sketchy. Sometimes we could get it, sometimes we were just too high up and the helicopters just couldn't fly there. We had vehicles with us. Those were mostly used, though, for transporting water and ammunition. Food, if there was room for it, there was a lot of times where we were living off of one MRE every other day. We were living on about 2 liters of water per day, sometimes less, but a good average would be about 2 liters of water per day. Temperatures were usually in the low hundreds, and we were at, I want to say up there, we were at somewhere around like 7,000 or 9,000 feet most of the time. So it took a lot out of us. I went on that deployment. I weighed about 215 pounds. I came off of it. I weighed about 150.
How was the unit resupplied?
For a while, they were using C-130s and airdropping pallets with food and water by parachute. If we were low enough, they would use helicopters, CH-53s from the Marine Corps or CH-47s from the Army. The Army was actually, they actually went out of their way to support us any way they could, which kind of surprised me. I thought there would be some kind of rivalry or something, but the Army pilots, even the flight crews, when they would do a resupply and they'd drop off chow and water, the crewman, one of the crewmen would usually come out with a trash bag or a box full of chewing tobacco, cigarettes, stuff like that for us too. Because that we don't get that in MREs anymore, but even they knew that, hey, this stuff helps. Here you go, guys. Don't worry about it. So their living conditions were pretty bad. We lived in holes in the ground almost the entire time. Food, for a while, we were living on grapes and watermelon and canal water. Once the general came down and he saw that and didn't approve, then we were living pretty good. They sent a field kitchen down to us. After that, we had regular food and water, and life was actually pretty good.
Of course, you had a hot shower every day. Right?
No. on that deployment, when we were done and we got relieved, we went back to Camp Leatherneck, and they had every person got a certain amount of water for showering per day. And I came back, and I was one of the we were there. We got back early in the morning. So there was nobody in the showers. The place was like a ghost town. Walked straight over to the shower, and they had a guard in the showers. And the guard was there to make sure people weren't using too much water. And I think I was in there for about 45 minutes total. But after I'd been in there for about 2 minutes, he went on some little tangent about everybody gets a certain amount of water per day. And I remember sticking my head out of the shower saying, I've been saving up for 7 months, leave me alone. And he, okay. And so, I mean, once you got up there, the guys who lived on the fobs, they kept their distance from the grunts. They didn't really mess with you. They didn't, if you took too much food in the chow line, they just ignored it. I think that was more to keep the grunts out of trouble, because they were already used to living like animals, and it wouldn't take much to set them off and start a fight. But the guys that actually lived at the FOB were also pretty good about making sure these guys didn't get themselves in trouble.
If you or someone you know is interested in donating materials or taking part in a veteran interview, please contact the museum. If you enjoy listening to this installment, listen to our past installments and be on the lookout for additional installments in the Voices from Afghanistan series. Thanks for listening.